Deutsche Welle. Inside Europe.
Hello and welcome to Inside Europe. I'm Helen Sini in Bonn. On today's programme, the strongmen of Russia and Turkey push the reset button on bilateral ties. How young Austrian men are literally fighting against radicalisation. Why foreigners are now in demand in Hungary. And how transatlantic ties could be impacted by a Trump presidency.
What does the West actually stand for anymore? Is it liberalism and openness and globalization, or is it something different? Nationalism, protectionism, religion? These are fundamental questions that I think both American and European citizens are going to face.
Those stories coming up on the program. They're friends again. Turkey and Russia took a big step toward normalizing relations this week. At a meeting in St. Petersburg, their leaders seized upon strained relations with the West to put aside their own history of acrimony. From Moscow, Charles Maines has the details.
Recent Russian-Turkish relations have always come down to the rapport between the country's two powerful and, some would argue, similarly authoritarian-leaning presidents. And so after a year of threats and sanctions and counter-threats, détente came down to a simple handshake between two men often billed as the Sultan and the Tsar. Turkish leader Recep Tayyip Erdogan traveled to meet with what he called his dear friend, Russian President Vladimir Putin, to say all was forgiven, or at least create the appearance it was, says Russian foreign policy analyst Vladimir Frolov.
The entire thing was primarily driven by the optics, to create the impression that there is some kind of a new alliance between Turkey and Russia, whereas in fact there is none. There is no geopolitical realignment.
Indeed, the past year has only seen tensions between the two sides grow. There was the downing of a Russian jet by Turkey last November amid Moscow's intervention into the Syrian conflict. There were the punitive travel and trade restrictions imposed by Moscow in response. And there was the Russian state media campaign demonizing the Turkish leader. But then a failed coup in Turkey in June. The ensuing violence left 280 dead. And Ankara, angry at its NATO allies in Washington and Brussels over their muted support amid the crisis and criticism of an ensuing government crackdown. Putin, no stranger to lecturing by the West on human rights, was soon on the phone expressing solidarity, and Erdogan offered an apology demanded by Moscow for the downing of the Russian jet. Foreign policy analyst Vladimir Frolov says in the end, both leaders seized the moment and a confrontation that simply was leading nowhere.
So they wanted to get out of this. They wanted to get out of the situation in which there could be a conflict with, you know, with a NATO member state. And so politically, they can afford a bald face. Erdogan emerged stronger politically from the coup. And for Putin, it has never been a problem to change tack 180 degrees.
Frolov and other observers say, ultimately, the Putin-Erdogan summit was designed to unsettle Western powers. Turkey is seeking to dampen criticism of its hardline tactics at home and force the EU's hand on a deal to guarantee visa-free travel in exchange for stemming the flow of migrants into Europe. Russia sees renewed Turkish relations as an opportunity to sow divisions in the NATO alliance. For now, the two leaders say they'll rebuild trade ties. The South Stream pipeline project to bring gas to Europe through Turkey appears back on. Russians, once again, are headed for the beaches of Turkey. Yet a sticking point remains the conflict in Syria. Both Russia and Turkey have faced terror at the hands of the Islamic State. But the Tsar and the Sultan have very different ideas over the fate of another authoritarian leader, Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. Charles Maines, DW, Moscow.
Many European countries remain on high alert after a spate of deadly attacks linked to Islamic State. This week, the Libyan Prime Minister, Fayez Sarraj, warned that the group will use every means to send its militants to Europe, not least of all via migrant boats across the Mediterranean. Islamic State, which is also known as IS or ISIS, has also been successful at recruiting European Muslims to their cause. But as Kerry Skyring reports from Vienna, a group of young Austrian men are fighting against radicalization, literally.
Down some stairs in a cellar in Vienna's second district is the Totsan Kampfsport Center, a fight sport or martial arts gymnasium. There's plenty of noise, there are fitness machines, it's brightly lit, it's colorful, and there are people throwing punches. It turns out this is multi-faith fighting.
We had people before, they didn't touch the hands, they didn't shake the hands of women, they didn't want to be in the same room with Jews. And now they train together, they practice Jews, Christians, Muslims. We have here Albanians with Serbs. We have here Jews with Chechens.
Alexander Karakas is a political scientist who also describes himself as a startup entrepreneur. He's a co-founder of Not in God's Name, an NGO and social media startup which aims to turn young Muslim men away from radicalization.
What we found out, that fighting sports testimonials can be the solution to this problem, because they are accessing the so-called lonely wolf. They're living it. Yeah?
The testimonials Alexander refers to are blogs and videos by famous fighters from different cultures and religions. They counterattack ISIS propaganda of the type that has inspired lone wolf style and a string of other violent terrorist attacks in Europe. Karim Mabruk is a famous Austrian-Egyptian boxer who has 22 wins and 6 knockouts to his name. He trains at this Vienna gym.
Der Islam bedeutet nicht, dass man irgendwo in den Krieg geht oder sonst irgendwas, sondern
Islam doesn't mean that you have to go and fight a war. Instead, there's this life here, to live it as well as possible and solve problems in peace. Normal work, normal schooling, to achieve something good and enhance the image of Islam, that's the most important. The war is not important.
The inspiration for Not in God's Name came when Alexander Karakas began researching the Charlie Hebdo attack in Paris. He says the perpetrators there and in the many subsequent terrorist attacks in Europe have a common interest.
Many of the jihadists have certain links to professional fighting sports. Either they are on their own engaged in professional fightings and then joined ISIS in Syria or Iraq, but for sure, many of the jihadists who did the attacks are somehow related to the fighting sports, either fans or watching it or going to the fighting sports competitions.
Alexander and a group of fitness and fighting trainers joined forces to recruit young men who were susceptible to radicalization, but to lead them into the boxing ring and away from jihad.
We de-radicalize and we do also preventive work. We already have a track record of young people who said, I was on the way to fight for and with ISIS, but now I'm here with you guys performing and celebrating the interfaith dialogue. And also, some of them de-radicalize. If they don't know, if they want to be part of something bigger, we can show them to be part of something bigger, and this is definitely not ISIS.
In the gym's cafe, young men meet and talk, young women too. This is where Mushta Al-Sabti was encouraged to come after a friend heard he was planning to join ISIS fighters in Syria.
Er hat gesagt, dort ist so und so nur Bürgerkrieg. Also, du bist noch zu jung.
He said to me, there is such a civil war there. Stay here. You are young. You are strong. You are good. Stay here. And I said, what can I do here? I have no job. I have nothing here. What do I do here? And he said, just take one step at a time. And I said, okay, and came here and got to know all the people. And now I have changed my ways. I have everything. I have work. I have training. My family is proud of me. Everyone is proud of me.
You may have the numbers and weapons, but your soldiers lack the will and resolve.
But ISIS internet propaganda, like this video, which taunts the West, is slick and for some convincing. Can this group of volunteers in a Vienna basement mount an effective counterattack? They are yet to receive any funds, but they are now in talks with Austria's foreign ministry, and interior ministry spokesman Karl-Heinz Grundberg says police can't tackle radicalization on their own.
Das heißt, hier ist diese Frage von Deradikalisierung eine gesamtgesellschaftliche Aufgabe.
Deradicalization is a task for the whole society and not the exclusive domain of the police. When there are initiatives that are doing something reasonable, then it is important to support them.
In the gym, a trainer gives instruction in how to land a blow and how to avoid one.
You have the trainers. Our trainers are more social therapists, psychological doctors. They went through all this. They were asylum seekers on their own when they came to us. They saw almost the same problems what other people witnessing. But they, a specific time in their life, they said, no, I go the right way.
Not in God's Name was invited to Brussels, where authorities hope the concept can help the youth of the troubled Molenbeek district. They're also in touch with the US State Department, which is keen to distribute the video testimonies of role model fighters condemning ISIS. Kerry Skyring, DW, Vienna.
The Hungarian government has taken a tough stance on immigration ever since the migrant crisis began to engulf Europe last summer. Hungary erected a fence on its southern border to stop the flow of migrants and refugees into its territory. And Prime Minister Viktor Orbán has been an outspoken critic of EU plans to resettle migrants across the bloc. But foreigners are now in demand in Hungary. A national business association has proposed bringing in migrants from non-EU countries to help deal with Hungary's labour shortage. Christina Jovanovsky reports.
The sun is out and so are the tourists at Hungary's Lake Balaton, the largest lake in Central Europe. Bustling restaurants are not in short supply of customers during the height of the tourism season. What is in need here, and all over Hungary, are workers. Waiters rush over to grab plates at the Bacardi Club. It's one of dozens of restaurants lining the main promenade in the town of Siófok, next to the lake.
Now we have five waiters, but it isn't enough. We need one more or two more waiters.
Benigno Németh, the manager of the restaurant, says the lack of workers is not a new problem, but it is one she cannot find a solution for.
The money is very good, I think. Everything is okay, but we can't find good workers. Everything I have tried, but I don't know why. So I can't understand that.
Tourism has been a booming sector in Hungary, with an 18% increase in foreign visitors from 2014 to 2015. The demand for staff will not be going down, but it's not the only industry affected. Hungary's National Business Association and the government say the whole country is going through a labor shortage. In total, around 35,000 jobs are vacant. A leading factor is a decreasing population due to a low birth rate and an aging population. Also, many young Hungarians leave the country to seek much higher wages in other EU countries. So, which sectors are hurting from the shortage?
All of them. All of them, I would not really distinguish.
That's Ferenc Rolek. He's the vice president of the Confederation of Hungarian Employers and Industrialists, which has presented the government with a proposal to bring in more foreign workers to Hungary.
You know, there are skilled workers or semi-skilled or even unskilled, which are needed, or even engineers, you know. And generally, the whole industry now is suffering from that. So it's very difficult, you know, to find people.
Hungary's state news agency reported that the economy minister, Mihai Varga, agreed that bringing in skilled labor from third countries, meaning non-EU citizens, should be supported. That got the attention of the local media, not least of all because the Hungarian government has been extremely critical of the influx of migrants into Europe. Budapest has repeatedly highlighted the link between terrorism and immigration. In October, the government will hold a referendum on whether the EU should be able to impose quotas for member states to resettle refugees. A day after Varga's comments, the economy minister released a statement saying he did not support bringing in what he called masses of unskilled, illiterate migrants. But he still echoed his support for foreign skilled workers. And it's not just Hungarian companies that are suffering from the labor shortage. The head of communications for the German Chamber of Commerce in Hungary, Duke Wolfer, says German businesses have limited their operations in the country. That is especially significant as Germany represents about a quarter of the foreign investment in Hungary.
We hear that quite often from German companies that they are looking for skilled workers. Of course, this is hindering more investment because in the short term, they won't be able to run production at full capacity if they don't have the workers.
The business association that proposed bringing in non-EU citizens had its own caveat that the workers need to be able to culturally integrate into Hungary. Franz Rolek from the Confederation of Employers and Industrialists again.
If you are an employer, you want to employ people who can fit to the company culture, who is able to deliver and to perform over there. If someone is very different, does not want to respect the laws and the discipline or whatever, or just culturally is not able or not willing to integrate, then it's difficult, you know, to run a company like this.
Martin Kahanitz is a professor of public policy, specializing in labor economics and immigration at Hungary's Central European University. He says other countries also look at a migrant's ability to integrate, such as with language skills. However, more diverse immigrants can end up providing more benefits to the economy.
If migrants who are exactly like us come, yes, that's true that they integrate rather easily, but also they do not bring new skills. But if migrants from more distant countries, maybe more distant cultures come in, they bring the skills and services and goods which are not so common here, and then it facilitates flow of ideas, creation of trade ties and business connections.
The Business Association has also proposed strategies to help Hungarian citizens meet the labor demand, such as improving education and training for the unemployed, and better cultural integration with the Roma minority, which faces especially high unemployment and widespread discrimination. These suggestions will be discussed with the government when talks resume in September. Christina Jovanovsky, Deutsche Welle, Budapest.
And I'm Helen Sini in Bonn. You're listening to Inside Europe. US officials have warned for decades that their disproportionately high financial support for NATO was not going to last forever, and that European governments must boost their own spending. But Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump has articulated those threats in a whole new way, warning Europe that mutual defence cannot be taken for granted. Support for Trump has dropped off in recent weeks, but for our next report, we head to Washington to hear what a Trump presidency could mean for transatlantic ties. Terry Schultz reports.
If Donald Trump becomes the U.S. president, he says he would rethink American engagement all over the world. But it's Trump's comments on NATO that have sent a chill down Europe's spine, though Trump may argue it doesn't have one.
NATO is obsolete and it's extremely expensive to the United States, disproportionately so, and we should readjust NATO.
Trump says before he, as president, would respond to a NATO call to defend an ally under the organization's bedrock principle of mutual defense, he'd first assess what that country had paid into the alliance, which he sometimes mistakenly describes as paying the U.S. Former U.S. Ambassador to NATO Kurt Volker agrees the gap between American and European defense spending is a well-known problem. But he says Trump's approach to the Article 5 Mutual Defense Clause is irresponsible and plays into the hands of Russian President Vladimir Putin.
I don't think it's a good idea to threaten that because you're sending the wrong signal to people like Putin who have invaded their neighbors, who have threatened NATO countries, who've buzzed our warships, they've threatened to attack Denmark with nuclear weapons.
Trump's views are so extreme that former Republican Party stalwarts have deserted him to publicly endorse his opponent, Hillary Clinton. Among them is Reuel Marc Gerecht, a so-called neoconservative, who's been very vocal, warning in an open letter how dangerous a Trump America would be.
If you'd asked me 18 months ago, could I envision voting for Hillary Clinton, the answer would have been no, I could not, but life is full of surprises.
As for whether Trump really would or could pull the U.S. out of NATO, Gerecht says if the candidate were to hold true to his statements on the campaign trail, there might not even be a NATO to quit.
Any president can, within his powers of commander-in-chief, could effectively gut NATO. And certainly by simple statements that he's already made, if he were to make them again after becoming president, that he would not honor Article 5, then NATO is de facto defunct.
Constanze Stelzenmüller, a senior fellow with the Brookings Institution, says even if Trump doesn't win and cut off U.S. support for NATO, damage has been done.
In politics, just talking about this kind of thing as a candidate who isn't even elected yet, that already has an impact on people's expectations and on the relationship in the now, as opposed to in November or in January. It is damaging the transatlantic relationship, which is based on trust and an assumption that we have a broad commonality of interests and values now. Because Europeans understand, I think, that Trump is not a singular phenomenon. He is a symptom of a broader mood.
A mood that sees Americans turning away not just from NATO, but from all international involvement. Eric Bratberg with the McCain Institute says another casualty will most certainly be the transatlantic free trade deal known as TTIP. It's already struggling under President Obama, who supports it. Bratberg says a Trump victory raises serious existential questions.
What does the West actually stand for anymore? Is it liberalism and openness and globalization, or is it something different? Nationalism, protectionism, religion? These are fundamental questions that I think both American and European citizens are going to face. And the elections, both here and other elections coming up in Europe, I think are going to be pivotal for how we respond to them.
Shahed Amanullah formerly advised the U.S. State Department on Muslim outreach and went on to co-found Affinis Labs, which helps launch Muslim-run startups all over the world. Amanullah says he fears already growing global Islamophobia would get significantly worse with a U.S. president who would ban Muslims from coming to America.
Trump doesn't realize that he will be putting gas on a fire that's going to make things worse for conflict in the Middle East. It's going to make things worse for integration in Europe. It's going to make things worse in terms of racial and ethnic tensions at home. I think the rest of us see it. I don't think he does.
It's unclear whom a President Trump would hire to carry out his policies. Former Ambassador Kurt Volker again.
And most of the people that I know who have had lots of experience in various administrations, but especially Republican administrations, they don't want to say that they would go work in a Trump administration. But what we say to each other is, I don't want to do it, but I want you to do it. Because we want sane people, good people who know policy, who know what they're doing.
On Monday, 50 prominent Republican national security officials released a joint statement calling Trump reckless and unqualified to lead the country, declaring none of them will vote for him. Terry Schultz, DW, Washington.
Just a reminder for you to get in touch with us if you have a comment or query about anything you've heard on the program. Our email address is europe@dw.com. That's europe@dw.com. Or you can write to us the old-fashioned way at Inside Europe, the English service, Deutsche Welle, Bonn, Germany. And we're looking forward to hearing from you. And you can also listen to the show on SoundCloud and iTunes. This is Inside Europe, and I'm Helen Sini in Bonn. This is Inside Europe, and I'm Helen Sini in Bonn. Coming up over the next half hour, the trafficking of Nigerian women into Europe for prostitution reaches crisis point.
Often they are accompanied either by other women, so-called madams. You know, they operate under the cover of friends or trusted confidants traveling with these women, and other times with so-called boyfriends or fiancés who are actually the traffickers themselves.
Also on the show, torture and disappearances on both sides of the conflict in eastern Ukraine. Life in Rome for a Muslim family, 4 months after the Pope throws them a lifeline. And how Scotland's Orkney Islands are reaping the benefits of wind and waves. Those stories and more coming up. A joint report published by Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch says both the Ukrainian authorities and Russian-backed separatists are holding civilians in prolonged, arbitrary and sometimes secret detention and torturing them. The report, called You Don't Exist, also claims that civilians on both sides of the conflict have been held captive as human currency for the purpose of prisoner exchanges. Phil Warwick has more from Kiev. Are you okay?
In their first joint report in 15 years, Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch chose to speak with one voice. A total of 40 interviews were conducted with victims of the alleged abuse, their family members, witnesses and lawyers. Those who were detained were held for periods of between 6 weeks to 15 months. Tanya Lokshina is a senior researcher at Human Rights Watch.
You can't say what the overall number of victims is, but we have very good grounds to believe that we are just scratching upon the surface, that the problem is much broader than the mere 18 cases that we documented.
Good afternoon.
Здравствуйте.
One of the victims mentioned is 59-year-old Konstantin Beskorovaine, a former member of the Communist Party of Ukraine, as well as a member of the local council in Konstantinivka, a small town in eastern Ukraine. He also works as a dentist in the local hospital. Last year, the Ukrainian authorities banned the Communist Party for promoting separatism. In turn, Amnesty International said the ban was a blow for freedom of speech. Caught in the middle was Konstantin, viewed as an easy target by the security services. During his detention, he was ill-treated and forced to confess on camera his role in planning a terrorist plot, using words dictated to him by his interrogators. He spent a total of 15 months in secret SBU detention sites, the majority of the time in the Kharkiv SBU secret facility. At the end of 2015, Konstantin's wife, Olga Shevchenko, contacted Amnesty International saying that her husband had been abducted by a group of armed masked men over a year earlier. Throughout 2015, she had approached the Ukrainian authorities and numerous state agencies for information leading to her husband's abduction. Either she didn't get an answer or the state organs denied that they were holding him. As Olga puts the kettle on, she explains the impact of the abuse her husband suffered at the hands of the Ukrainian authorities.
It's difficult to talk about what happens to a person who's detained. The people who abused my husband did a thorough job. He's not the same man that I once knew. He's a changed person who's been crushed and trampled on.
While in detention, Konstantin came into contact with other people who had been forcibly disappeared by the Ukrainian authorities. At one point, there were as many as 72 people in the secret Kharkiv SBU compound. Most of them were later exchanged for prisoners held by the pro-Russian separatists. There have long been allegations against the American secret services, the CIA, who are known to use so-called black sites. Rachel Denber, the Human Rights Watch European Deputy Director, thinks that the Ukrainian authorities are doing something similar.
We have serious information about the SBU using its facilities for secret detention. Our report documents a few cases, but that raises the question of how many more are there out there. After we finished putting this report together, we learned of yet two other cases of people who were held in secret detention.
According to Konstantin, during those 15 months, he turned to reading religious literature, and that his faith helped him throughout that difficult time.
I began to read religious literature, and we would pray during meal times. And so I would start every morning with a prayer and conclude the day with a prayer. I held the belief that with my faith I would return. I hoped to get through this and get back home. This was a spiritual test sent by God.
As the conflict raged on in eastern Ukraine, Konstantin was offered for exchange several times. However, the swap didn't take place, as the Russian-backed separatist apparently did not want him. Tanya Lokshina explains Konstantin's case.
The thing is that the other side does not want to get civilians instead of combatants. So it appears that when the other side is being approached with the lists of people offered for exchange, they go like, who is this guy? He's what, like 59 years of age? He's no combatant, we don't want him. So in the end, in the course of 15 months, the authorities were unable to exchange him, and in the end, they released him. That's how we got to know him.
In February 2016, the SBU told Konstantin that though prison exchanges had ceased, the security services were prepared to let him go on the condition that he repeated his forced confession on camera. Beskorovaine did as he was told. To him, it was a ticket home. Now that Konstantin and his wife are reunited, he's hoping that he can rebuild his personal and professional life. But according to Tanya Lokshina, he might not be out of the woods just yet.
They clearly warned him that speaking up about the circumstances of his detention and the circumstances of his forced stay at the SBU compound was against his best interests, and he could face very serious repercussions.
Konstantin, however, decided to speak out. He wants to see accountability and justice here in his motherland of Ukraine. Denis Krivoshev, Amnesty International European Deputy Director, says they'll be keeping an eye on Konstantin to make sure he is not disappeared once more.
When suddenly a person appears with a direct testimony, those people tend to disappear again or retract their testimonies. That does not happen out of their free will. We suspect the risk is here as well of that same pattern being repeated. We'll be watching to make sure it doesn't happen.
The report's authors say that there is still much fear surrounding illegal detentions. Many families of alleged victims are too scared to speak out, even with the promise of legal and financial compensation if their cases are brought out in the open. Prior to the report, Ukraine's secret services had denied all claims of secret facilities and detained civilians. Now the Kyiv authorities have promised to investigate the allegations, but the fear remains that the agencies involved are far more powerful than the law and that they won't get the legal redress promised. Konstantin hopes that by speaking out and defying the authorities who detained him, he will bring the world's attention to what's going on in Ukraine and will save himself from being disappeared again. Amnesty and Human Rights Watch hope that his bravery will help force a lasting change, but the wheels of the investigation are expected to turn slowly. Philip Warwick, DW, Kyiv.
The number of Nigerian women being trafficked into Europe is reaching crisis levels. That's according to the UN's International Organization for Migration, or IOM. Most of these women arrive in Italy on migrant boats from Libya, and it's believed that more than 80% of them are then forced into prostitution across the continent. Federico Soda is the director of the IOM's Coordination Office for the Mediterranean, which is based in Rome. He first explained the scale of the problem.
The reason that it's reaching very concerning proportions is that we've seen a growth from year on year from 2013 up to today. And in 2016, from January until now, we are almost at the level of the entire period for 2015. We have had 5,300 Nigerian women registered arriving in Italy in 2016, and all of 2015 was 5,600. So very, very significant increase.
Can you explain how these women are lured from Nigeria to Italy and how this trafficking process works?
There are different methods and techniques. I was speaking with some women that we have helped provide assistance to yesterday in Sicily, and they were telling me that they didn't know that they were going to be eventually exploited for sex in Europe, and that, in fact, their families had been guaranteed that this would not be the case, that they were aware of the risk, but they had been told that would not be the end result. And so they left quite sure that that is not what they would be subject to. Others are more aware of the fact that they will end up as sex workers, but almost never aware of just how brutal the conditions will be, unaware that they will be working literally on the streets, unaware that they will be subject to abuse and violence en route, and then certainly once the destination is reached. So I think, you know, it's not the same experience by any stretch for all of them, but the end result for the vast majority of them will be the same. We estimate that up to 80% of the Nigerian women that arrived are trafficked.
But are these traffickers also Nigerian?
Yes. Often they are accompanied either by other women, so-called madams. You know, they operate under the cover of friends or trusted confidants traveling with these women, and other times with so-called boyfriends or fiancés who are actually the traffickers themselves.
So Nigerian women are specifically targeted by these traffickers. Is this also a problem in other African countries as well?
Well, we think it could be, though not to the same extent. We have a much higher proportion of Nigerian women. Nigeria is the number one nationality overall of arrivals to Italy this year. We've had 18,500 Nigerian nationals, men and women, arrive so far this year. And we know that they are at higher risk. We will be strengthening our resources at the landing points in the coming months with the support of the Italian government to improve the identification and detection, because we need to also start looking more carefully at the identification of other nationalities and groups.
Now, once they arrive in Italy, these women are put into reception centres. Now, theoretically, they should be safe there, but do you believe this actually plays into the hands of traffickers?
They're not recruited out of these centres, but if they don't seek the protection to which they are entitled to under Italian law, and basically are processed like other migrants that are not trafficked, then they are accommodated in these centers and the traffickers know where to find them and simply take them out. These centers are open centers. So, you know, it's not possible to compel an adult to accept assistance or protection. And if they are either unaware of what is going to happen for the reasons I've described, or if they are too scared to seek assistance and advice and protection, then the traffickers know where to find them and they will take them out.
And they're then farmed out across the entire continent, I believe.
Yes, we know that women that have been identified at the landing points here have ended up in all sorts of other parts of Europe.
So what other action are you recommending in conjunction with the Italian authorities?
We absolutely need to strengthen identification of trafficked persons, not just at the landing points, but throughout the territory. Indeed, we are only able to assist a small percentage at the landing points, though we are able to identify many. We believe that government authorities, law enforcement, and social workers need to be more aware of the identification process of trafficked persons, because they're quite likely to come across them but not necessarily identify them as such. We need to do more on prosecutions of traffickers and the criminal networks, and we need to do more on prevention and protection measures that can be taken at the points of origin. More can be done in transit as well, and we have the opportunity to intercept, inform, and try to sensitize the migrants of the risks that they likely will be subject to, particularly if they are women, in context not just of being trafficked, but gender-based violence is quite systemic en route.
And that was Federico Soda from the International Organization for Migration, speaking there from Rome. Well, for some of the migrants and refugees arriving here in Europe, there is a happy ending. Last December, a Muslim couple and their young son escaped from Syria with just the clothes on their backs after their husband was called up to fight. They were smuggled through Turkey and then across the Aegean Sea to the Greek island of Lesbos. Then in April, the unthinkable happened. Pope Francis visited the island and took the family, along with two others, back to Italy with him. They're now adjusting to their new home in Rome. Dale Gavlak caught up with them to see how things are going.
I've arrived at the language learning center of the community of Sant'Egidio, located in Trastevere, Rome. They are the community that has taken in Syrian refugees, but offer language courses to all the other refugees in Italy. I speak with Cecilia Pani, a senior member of the community.
The first refugees came to Italy in the late 80s, and the first one we met was a Somali man dying in the street because some Italian guys had burned him. So he, Ali Jama, was the first refugee we met. So up to now we had more than 100,000 students.
It's at the school that I meet Noor Issa and her husband Hassan Zahde, who, along with their two-year-old son Riyad, were rescued from Lesbos by Pope Francis. They speak in English and Arabic to me about their transition to life in Italy and language studies.
So we start going to school now. We start learning Italian. My son also is starting going to school. He's mixing the two languages. For example, he pasta. For example, he says to me, "Mama, بدي أقوى. Mama, قواردة طيارة."
نحن عم نهتم يعني في اهتمام شخصي بالمنزل.
Learning Italian is not very difficult. We are focusing our energies on this, whether in class, at home, or with internet programs. We've been studying the basics, and people are also helping us learn how to put together sentences properly. We now understand a lot of what people are saying.
Here's Cecilia again.
Yes, it will take time, but they really fight and try to integrate. They want to learn Italian language. They attend classes. We offer them even during Ramadan, which is quite hard for them.
Romano,
okay.
We're professional people, still are. It's hard to suddenly just be learning language, isn't it?
It's hard because now you are starting from the zero. You are starting to build everything, the language. You must prove yourself here and you must search for another job.
As the Pope's refugees, it could be taken for granted that life and its problems for these 30-year-olds and the other Syrians who boarded the papal plane have been instantly solved. But of course, they haven't. It will take a lot of effort to realize the Italian La Dolce Vita, or sweet life. In Syria, Noor was a microbiology student and Hassan a landscape designer. Noor switches to Arabic to explain further.
We're starting from scratch in Italy. Maybe we'll have to work in another field, not the field we trained in and worked in before. All those years we spent studying and working hard in Syria may be useless here. Although we're well educated, there's a lot of effort involved in trying to find the way forward for your new life. It's a big struggle. Having to prove yourself isn't easy. We also think about our family all the time, because they are still in Syria.
So, Cecilia, how do you see the Syrian refugees who've come from Lesbos adapting to Italian life, Italian culture?
First, we asked them to live in a common space with other people who were not Syrian, who were African people or other countries, in order to see also the difference. It's very important to let them help other people. So the first who have come were asked to help the newcomers to cook for them, to welcome them, to help them translating in Italian. We try to do something in the everyday life.
I would assume that that's one of the values that you try to instill in the refugees that are coming, to see themselves as part of a bigger family, maybe.
It's very important because they see that we are all volunteers, that we are a community, and what we do is just for friendship. So this is the first step also to let them integrate in this family.
We would like to give a very big thank you to Italy, and special thanks to the Pope. Since we arrived, it's been something of a dream, seeing the blessing of Rome. For us, it resembles the ancient city of Damascus. If there was no war, I know many Syrians would return home. But in the absence of peace, we ask others to open their doors to the Syrians.
And we like also to thank the community of Sant'Egidio of all things that they have done for us.
Dale Gavlak, DW Rome.
And I'm Helen Sini in Bonn. You're listening to Inside Europe. Humans have long depended on the sea as a source of food and a way to travel. Today, the world's oceans offer another essential resource, energy. Scotland's Orkney Islands boast optimal conditions for harnessing energy from waves, currents, and tides. So scientists and engineers from around the world visit the islands to test various technologies. Sandy Houseman travelled to the archipelago to find out what marine energy means for local residents and what challenges lie ahead for countries hoping to harvest power from the sea.
The Orkney Accordion and Fiddle Club meets weekly to celebrate old-fashioned Scottish music, and there are a growing number of enthusiasts on this island between the North Sea and the Atlantic. 73-year-old Innes Wiley is delighted by the newcomers.
I used to play in pipe bands back in the 60s, and if you got 9 pipers out, you're doing well. No, they can probably 24, 25.
One reason for this growing population is a booming new industry, harvesting power from the wind and water. As many as 350 people on Orkney now work with green energy technologies, a development that doesn't surprise Wiley.
I think it's an excellent idea because we've got plenty of wind and we've got plenty of waves.
In fact, he's got a couple of wind turbines on his farm and he's hoping to benefit from research nearby at the European Marine Energy Centre, or EMEC. Lisa McKenzie speaks for that non-profit laboratory.
The purpose of EMEC is to get devices into real sea conditions and get them tested in the really challenging saltwater conditions that we've got here in Orkney. They're testing how to install devices, how they survive in the really harsh conditions.
Harsh indeed. The centre's managing director, Neil Kermode, says waves here average 2 to 3 metres, but in stormy weather, they can swell to 18.
To build a piece of machinery that's capable of withstanding that is a big ask. But you've also got to make them so that they are flexible enough to react to the waves. So trying to make something that is flexible, durable, cost-effective and works is quite a big technical ask.
The tides here are also powerful, rushing in and out at about 11 kilometres an hour. And a local company, Scott Renewables, is determined to take advantage of that.
We've got the tides of the North Sea meeting the tides of the Atlantic Ocean, and as the tides are filtered through these very narrow channels between the islands, the currents pick up, and that's why we've got some of the best tidal currents in the world.
But engineer James Murray says it can be difficult and expensive to install turbines. A special boat and crane are needed to plant generators on the ocean floor, and that costs about 200,000 euros a day. So the company has devised tidal turbines that can be towed using almost any small boat.
Because the turbine is floating, we can use much smaller vessels and essentially tow the floating turbine out to sea and onto site. The retractable rotors are lowered, the brakes released, and the turbine can be generating within the space of about half an hour. So it's quite a different approach.
Scott Renewables has been working on its device, which looks like a bright yellow submarine, for more than a decade, with support from a government hoping to see economic impact well beyond Orkney.
We're also putting the superstructure together in Northern Ireland at the Harland and Wolff shipyard where the Titanic was built. Hopefully we'll have better luck than the Titanic. And then there's various components, the steel work, all that is coming from Wales, and we've got the blades coming from the south of England. So really drawing on all the best expertise in the United Kingdom.
Ireland also offers a demonstration centre for marine energy. John Breslin is general manager of Smart Bay, where he's seen slow but steady progress. I spoke with him at an international conference on renewable energy in Washington, D.C.
If you look how long it took to actually develop the modern wind turbine, it took 25 years. What's happening at the moment is consolidation. We have lots of different types of devices that harness power in different ways. We're going to see some people drop off. But what will happen over the next 5 to 10 years is a device or a few types of devices will emerge. And that's when this industry will really take off.
Meanwhile, scientists are studying the environmental impacts of marine energy technologies. Gareth Davies is a marine biologist who consults with energy companies in 20 countries. He says the noise made by marine turbines could be a problem for some mammals, but they would probably just swim away.
There are instances of where whales and dolphins and seals, and indeed fish, have been shown to react to persistent and loud sources of noise. The oil and gas industry undertakes seismic surveys, which are one of the loudest noises that man gives rise to in the sea. Large shipping also can cause avoidance behaviour. The levels of noise that big supertankers generate is far, far greater than any of the noise that comes from the renewable energy devices.
And he notes that existing energy sources are a bigger threat to wildlife, with oil spills fouling their waters, coal and gas polluting the air, and excess carbon dioxide in the atmosphere causing the oceans to acidify. It is possible, however, that creatures in the ocean will cause problems for marine energy devices. Sarah Henkel is with the Hatfield Marine Science Center at Oregon State University on America's west coast, where sea lions abound. They're big, heavy animals, and they love to lounge on buoys, boats, anything that floats in the sea. So Henkel says they could interfere with turbines tethered to the surface to convert the energy of waves, tides, and currents to electricity.
There's a lot of engineering and design going into how do you shape this or coat this with Teflon so that a sea lion can't climb up on it and hang out, because it would definitely affect the performance of your energy-generating device if a sea lion was sitting on it.
Other marine mammals could become tangled in lines that hold turbines in place. But Henkel says collisions are unlikely. Birds that crash into land-based turbines may be flying 80 kilometers an hour, but ocean creatures move much more slowly. But the biggest impediment to rapid development of marine energy is cost. Until the industry agrees on a few top technologies, there are no economies of scale. What's more, prices of alternatives like oil and natural gas are down. Still, EMEC Director Neil Kermode thinks climate change will eventually compel the world to get clean, renewable energy from the sea.
We can't just keep burning our way through 1 cubic mile of fossilised swamp goo every year. We have to do something else. We are pressing on very hard because we absolutely know there's energy in the water out there, and we know that we're going to need this stuff. When will it happen? I just don't know. But the thing is, we're a lot closer to it than we were before we started. We have done that piece of alchemy of turning seawater into electricity. We can make this work.
Scientists at the European Marine Energy Center can also use power from the ocean to remove hydrogen from seawater, creating a fuel that can be stored and transported. And they're working on the best ways to get electricity generated on Orkney to the Scottish mainland. Sandy Houseman, DW, Orkney Islands, Scotland.
And that's all we've time for on the show. I hope you enjoyed it. It was produced with help from Natalie Muller and sound engineer Thomas Schmidt. And I'm Helen Sini. We'll be back at the same time next week. Inside Europe comes to you from DW in Bonn.